Welcome to Are You Quizzing Me? I am Vineet Nair with my co-host Aditya Kashyap. This is a quizzing trivia podcast show. Join us as we dive deep into history, science, pop culture, and so much more. Let's get quizzing. Welcome back to episode number 64 of Are You Quizzing Me? Your favorite quizzing and trivia podcast show. Today, we have a very special episode, but I'll keep you in a little suspense as to what's so special about it today. Let's start off today's episode, as usual, with our audience question. I will answer this question at the end of today's episode. So stay tuned till the very end, and you can try and guess in the meantime what the answer to this question is. So today's question for you, my dear audience, is this. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology, better known as MIT, will award you a certificate in X if you take archery, pistols, sailing, and fencing as your required physical education classes. So what is X? In what will you receive a certificate at MIT if you take archery, pistols, sailing, and fencing as your required physical education classes? I will reveal the answer to this at the end of today's episode. Now, as usual, we go to the not-so-serious portion of our episode with Aditya answering his not-so-serious question from last week. Aditya, over to you.
So the question I asked last week was if George Reddy and his followers were truly fighting for something not very profound, but something very, I would say, immaterial, what would that be? And it's very clear because they were students. They'd be fighting for marks.
Oh, God.
They were marks.
Oh, God. That's physically painful. That is so physically painful.
You're welcome.
I really have to apologize to somebody else now on the podcast, which is what I have to tell everybody, that we have a guest. We have a guest quizmaster today. And someone who's of, let's say, a much higher caliber when it comes to quizzing and running quizzes than we are. So I would like everyone and Aditya to welcome Rajiv De Silva. Rajiv is a quizmaster, an architect by trade. He runs a design studio based in Goa. He says he came to quizzing relatively late in his life, which is his late 20s. But now he has been at it for nearly two decades. As a person living in Goa, I can attest to the fact that he's a fantastic quizmaster. An interesting fact about Rajiv is that he's also a birder. And he co-founded the Goa Bird Conservation Network. My question to you, Rajiv, what is a birder and is it different from a bird watcher?
Okay. So first of all, Vineet, Aditya, thanks for having me on this podcast. I'm losing my podcast virginity basically today because I've never done this before.
We'll be gentle.
Wow.
You have to be gentle, yeah. Right? So there's no difference between bird watcher and birder. It's pretty much the same thing. The difference between an ornithologist and a birder or a bird watcher is that an ornithologist watches birds more for the science of it, to study what the bird does and habits and maybe a larger, bigger aim. Whereas a bird watcher or a birder, short for bird watcher, watches it just for the pleasure of it. So I'm a birder, so I don't go around looking for birds and then study it in detail and, you know, count the number of metatarsals and the tarsals and the primaries and all that kind of thing. I don't get into that. So we are doing it merely for the pleasure of it. That's not to say that the scientists are not doing it for pleasure. They're doing it for pleasure also. But having said that, there's in recent times, there's a lot of science that the casual bird watcher also contributes to, actually. So because a lot of data and, you know, especially, you know, things about migration patterns and distribution of certain species and all this is all crowdsourced data. And so everybody, when I go out and watch birds and I keep a list of what I've seen where and I upload it to a database, then any scientist sitting anywhere can use that data to draw their own conclusions about, you know, whatever they're studying. So that's the kind of, that's the difference or non-difference between birder and ornithologist.
That's great. Now that's a first TIL for us because I had no clue that there was difference between, because frankly speaking, I thought everybody who studied birds and were ornithologists and bird watchers was just like a hobby. But yes, now that I know that you guys actually contribute to science, it makes you even more impressive, Rajiv, even though you had an already impressive resume.
Okay, I don't have to do anything extra to contribute to science. That happens like automatically.
Exactly. So Rajiv, you know the format and you are our guest. So as usual, we let our guests go first. So, first question of episode number 64 to you, Rajiv.
Okay. Happy to go ahead. But I must preface my first question by saying that I have no clue whether this is going to be hard or difficult or easy or what. And I've just selected a bunch of questions from my own quizzes I've done. And let's see how they bounce off you guys. So, okay. I'll start with possibly a shortish one. Here goes. So, what is the exact distance between the east terrace of Windsor Castle and a point which is directly, or which was directly in front of the royal enclosure of the main venue of the Franco-British Exhibition of 1908? So, in 1908, there was a building that was built for the Franco-British Exhibition of that year, which was the royal enclosure, which was obviously the place where the royals would sit and watch whatever. And there is also Windsor Castle, right? So what is the exact distance between the east terrace of the Windsor Castle and this royal enclosure? And, and it might sound like this is a question that you can't get. But the thing is that you as a quizzer might know the actual distance, but I'm not necessarily looking for an exact distance. So you have to tell me, or what is that exact distance?
Wow.
I'm assuming this has something to do with something iconic in the French-English relations.
No. So don't go down that route.
Oh, okay. All right. Already blind alley. Okay.
Yeah. You had at least that to go on. This question has bounced off my head like water off a duck's back, frankly speaking. Now, I'm thinking there has to be some kind of clever trick behind this. There must be some connect which I'm not getting. The east tower of Windsor Castle, you mentioned, right?
Yes, the east terrace, yeah.
The east terrace of Windsor Castle. There has to be some logic behind it. He wouldn't ask if there wasn't some kind of logic.
Well, there's not too deep logic in the east terrace. I'll tell you the only logic is that the east terrace of the Windsor Castle is where the royals sit and watch stuff happen in front of them.
Okay.
Right? So in both cases, something was being watched from the east terrace of Windsor Castle and the royal enclosure of the exhibition. And since, so I think the main clue is the year here. It's 1908.
Wait, is this the distance between Britain and India?
No, not a distance between Britain and India.
No, because because for a second I was, when was the Royal Darbar when, what was his name? When King George came to India, where we inaugurated the Gateway of India. That was in 1900-something, right? It was in the first 10 years of something, right?
Maybe, but no connection with that. Okay, I'm going to make it a little easier. Obviously, I started off with a little bit of a brain twister. But basically, if this were one of those quizzes where you had to categorize by topic, this would be a sports question.
I thought about this.
Okay.
Man, Vineet, I wish I had not let you lead with the history, because that's not my strong suit. But okay, I don't have a very direct answer, but my chain of thought is the distance could be the more than the maximum distance of some sort of javelin throw or shot put or something. Like, they were just trying to avoid the potential of somebody getting hurt. So I'm assuming
okay, at least you've gone in the sports, but no. Vineet, do you want to take a guess or do you want me to give another clue?
No, I was thinking more on the lines of it might be either, I think tennis would be my first. Is it the tennis court, the distance of a tennis court or something like that?
No.
Or cricket, that would be the second guess.
No, so these two locations are quite a distance apart, not very close by. So I'll give you a clue.
Okay.
Basically, it was a start point, an end point of something. And this was a start point and end point because royals were watching when it started and royals were watching when it ended.
Is it like a marathon then?
It's the 1908 Olympics.
It's the 1908
Olympics, the London Olympics. Oh,
yeah, that's correct. So basically, until 1908, the marathon used to be some random distance depending on the city where it was happening. There was no fixed distance. So for 1908, they had the exact the starting point and end point, and after that, they decided to standardize the length, right?
Okay.
And so they measured East Terrace to Royal Enclosure, and they found that it was 26 miles and 385 yards, which is till this day the standard length, the current length of a marathon. So it came from there. Basically, that's the question.
Oh, wait, that's very interesting, because I was under the assumption that it had to do with the Greek legend of that guy who ran, basically. Wasn't that 26 miles?
The Battle of Marathon.
Yeah. It was roundabouts, yes. But as an Olympic sport, until 1908, it was, because also they had to keep records and stuff. Until 1908, they didn't have a specific distance. They would say, okay, around 26 miles, around 42 kilometers, and it would be a little variation. And after 1908, decided to standardize it, they took it from the London Olympics, and that was the exact distance, which is why everybody runs 26 miles, 385 yards.
Oh, cracker, cool. Cracker. He has thrown down the gauntlet with the first question. Okay.
Oh, shit.
Okay. Benchmark.
No, serious. That was a seriously good question, by the way. That was a seriously good question. I really like that. I'm stealing that question, by the way, for some quiz. You're not attending it.
Okay, go ahead. Yes. Okay, now let's hear one of yours.
Okay, I'll go next. So I'm going to give you a list, because it's usually Aditya who tortures me with lists, listicle questions. Mm. So I'm going to give a list, right? So I'm going to give you a list of names, okay? They're very difficult to pronounce, so bear with me with my atrocious pronunciations. First is a pair. Okay, some of them are pairs, some of them are individual names, some of them are three names in groups, okay?
Yeah.
The first one would be Eugene Edward Monod and Alphonse Lavier. The second is Jan Wills. The third is Gustave Sack, Pierre Bailly, and Pierre Montenot. Number four, or the fourth in this list, is Hermann Kutschera. Number five is Adolf Hock. Number six is Alfred Hensel. Number seven is John Hughes. Number eight is Werner March and Walter March. And the last is Yerjo Lindegren. I don't expect anybody, and like, if you can answer this off the trot, na, I would literally crown you king of quizzes in the world. But this is an exhaustive list in this particular category. Okay. Even if you give me something related to it, I will happily give you the points. So this is the connect. Does this ring any bells at all?
So what you want to know is, what is this a list of?
What is this a list of?
Not one name on that list rang any bells for me.
I'm so clueless right now, and I'm so glad I'm not the only one.
The only exception was the last one, which sounded like the actor Dolph Lundgren, but it wasn't that, right?
No. It's Yergo Lindegren.
Oh, sorry. Then I'm clueless. I have to pass up. Okay, Aditya, you go ahead.
You also said Walter March.
Werner March and Walter March.
March.
M-A-R-C-H.
I think there is a sound designer by something similar in Hollywood, some similar name, but I don't know if I'm anywhere close.
How many numbers in your list, in this list? There were eight or nine, no?
Nine.
So nine, and how many of them were more than one?
So the first one was there were two people, Eugene Edward Monod and Alphonse Lavier. Number three was Gustave Sack, Pierre Bailly, and Pierre Montenot. And number eight was Werner March and Walter March.
Eight.
The first one is, as I mentioned, Eugene Edward Monod and Alphonse Lavier are Swiss. Jan Wills is from the Netherlands. Gustave Sack, Pierre Bailly, and Pierre Montenot are from France. Hermann Kutschera was from Austria. Adolf Hock from Austria. Alfred Hensel was from Germany. John Hughes from Great Britain. Werner March, Walter March, again from Germany. And Yerho Lindgren from Finland.
Okay, just going by the countries they are from, is it like mountaineers who have done all the 14ers or something.
No. Unfortunately not. Let me just say that these are forgotten people.
Oh.
Let's say that the category to which these people belong to, there are entire databases of this, of related types of categories, but they are not included. These people are not included. They've been completely forgotten. Like if, say, for example, there is a website. Actually, there is a website, an official website you can go to, where there are, you know, categories and lists of all the people who, you know, have similar, who belong to similar lists like this. But you won't find their names. The names I've told you, you won't find them. They've been forgotten. They've been erased from history.
And are you able to give us a time frame on this?
Yes, very good. That was going to be my clue next. Okay, so 1912 was Eugene Edward Monod and Alphonse Lavière. 1928 was Jan Wills. Alfred Hensel was also 1928. 1932 was Gustav Sack, Pierre Bally, Pierre Montenot, and John Hughes was also 1932. 1936, it was Hermann Kutschera, then Werner March and Walter March. And 1948 was Adolf Hoch and Jirgo Lindgren.
Well, just getting going by the year, this is some Olympics funder.
Aha. Okay, now you're very warm.
Yeah.
Now you're very warm.
So are these the gold medalists in, you know, the Olympics used to give those other weird gold medals in architecture and art?
This is why I told you that we should have a handicap for this fellow. Yes, these are all the gold medalists in architecture.
Oh, okay, fine. Well, you had this question.
No, I put one architecture question in the, actually two, a couple of architecture questions, because I knew that he'd be coming on the show. So I was like, I should have something related to architecture.
Okay, well, yeah. Okay. So lucky guess, I guess.
Yeah, no, but that was a great crack. So again, for those in our audience who did not know, the Olympics actually had an art section. So there used to be awards given, medals given for architecture. The terms, actually the names of the events were mixed architecture in 1912, which they changed to two different categories later on, which was called mixed architecture or architectural designs. And the second one was town planning. So Werner March and Walter March got it for town planning.
Wow.
In addition, there were gold medals for sculpting, painting, art, poetry. So literature also was another category that was given. Another piece of trivia I'd like to tell you guys. You know Pierre de Coubertin, who was the guy who started the modern day Olympics. Yes. He won an Olympic gold medal.
Yeah, I've heard this funda somewhere. Although I don't remember what it was. It was in one of these categories.
Yes. So he won the gold medal for literature at the 1912 Summer Olympics for his poem Ode to Sport. Thing is, he was a Frenchman, as evidenced by his name, Pierre de Coubertin. But he won, the medal went to Germany.
Why?
Because he entered this poem, the name of the poem was Ode to Sport, under the pseudonym of Georges Horod and M. Eschenbach, which were names of villages close to his wife's place of birth in Germany. So the medal technically now still shows as German, it's a German medal, but he's a Frenchman.
Okay, interesting.
So yeah, these are the gold medalists in architecture. Well cracked, Rajiv, well cracked.
That was exceedingly impressive. I was practically useless for that question, but I loved it. Just being a spectator to that was, I believe, how Olympic spectators must have felt watching the merchants design their city, I guess. I don't know. How do you even compete over that? That is really fun. Yeah, but great.
Okay, Rajiv, back to you.
Oh, back to me again. Okay, I will do a history question, I think. Okay, if you go to a place called Indora in Pathankot, I don't think anybody normal has ever been there, but there is a small place called Indora in Pathankot.
Normal?
I mean, you wouldn't go there as a tourist, I guess.
Okay.
Maybe, I don't know. And so there's a Shiv temple called the Katghar Shiv temple there. The temple that's there today is like just a modern standard temple kind of thing. But its Shivling is said to be very, very old and traced back to the original temple, which was supposed to be built in 326 BC. A shivling at the Kadgar temple is 326 BC. So the original temple, which was built in 326 BC, is believed was built to commemorate something, right? And so that spot where the original temple was built, where the modern temple still lies, is believed to mark the exact spot of what turning point in Indian history?
You said 326 BC?
Yes, 326 BC.
That would be Alexander?
That was going to be my guess. Alexander and Porus.
That is correct. So collectively, you've got that answer correct. So that's apparently the spot where Alexander's armies gave up and turned back and went back.
Oh.
So that's my turning point. Yeah. Well done, Vineet Aditya. Yes, that's where Alexander returned.
I love the phrasing for that. That is such a classic quizmaster thing to do. Turning point. I love it. Very nice.
Yeah. Very nice.
It was to Porus that Alexander asked him, how would you like to be treated? And he said, I would like to be treated like a king.
Correct. Yeah, that's the one, yeah. But eventually, as everyone knows history, that he was defeated not by Porus or anybody else, but by disease and whatever else.
Tuberculosis is what they suspect.
And homesickness and all that kind of stuff. Whatever it is, it stopped him from marching over through the rest of India. So, worked well for him.
Yeah. Yes. So, the next question is Aditya's.
Yep.
Man, I had so many jokes per question, but I was trying to be serious. But okay, I'm going to stop. No, I don't know. I'm going to take my opportunity since you guys have given me the mic at this point. Because firstly, when a marathon happens, I think it's the most ridiculous way to honor somebody who ran 26 miles and then died by running 26 miles and celebrating after that.
Yeah.
Really, really rude to do that.
Yeah.
And then Alexander obviously died because he was sick under...
Oh, God.
Okay, fine.
All right. Okay. I'm not even leaving it for the next episode. Doing it right now. All right. So since Vineet did tell me a little bit about you and told me about the legendary status you have in Goa and its quizzing community.
What? Hardly, yeah. Come told on, me about... Vineet. I think you need to...
No. You're being too modest, Rajiv. Own it!
So I had to prepare questions specially for you. So my first question is obviously going to be, what is the airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow?
Wait. This is actually a chestnut. I've heard this somewhere.
You have. I would imagine you have, yes.
Yeah, but is this a serious question or is this a joke?
No, this is not a serious question. I imagine there is an actual answer. And I would encourage anybody in our audience who knows the answer to type it in our comments. But no, I have an actual question. I'm not going to...
Enough, Monty Python for today.
That was Monty Python. That's why I was trying to see where I'm at.
Yes, that is Monty Python. Okay. The question I'm actually going to ask is from the world of movies.
Okay.
And this has to do with mostly English films. So hopefully you're up to date on your Hollywood trivia. I'm going to name a bunch of films since when
you
did
I hate you.
Lists.
I hate you. I told and, you I hate list questions and he purposely does this.
You will get this, I'm pretty sure. So tell me what is common between them, okay? And these are all pretty famous movies. Oliver Stone's famous movie Platoon. We also have on this list the movie 1917, the World War I movie. We have Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. We have MCU's Infinity War. And this was also technically not a movie, but The Walking Dead. What is common between all of them?
Okay, let me just ask a quizzer question here. Is this an exhaustive list?
No.
No. So there are more.
Yes, many, many more.
Wow, I can't.
Platoon, The Prisoner of Azkaban. Which was the second one you mentioned after Platoon?
1917,
right.
1917.
When you said 1917 after Platoon, my mind was, is there a single shot in Platoon?
I remember there exactly, isn't.
Yeah.
No, these are not, nothing to do with. Okay, so this is a very, very open-ended question as of now. So let me narrow it down a little bit more for you guys. I'm looking for what would be considered on the IMDb page a goof. Something that all of these movies messed up.
Oh, okay. Are these where anachronisms appear in the movie? Oliver Stone's Alexander. There's a watch that appears, right? And there's a plane you can see in the background. Is it something like that?
Classic example, like Game of Thrones episode where there's a Starbucks cup.
Yeah.
No. That I imagine that there's a much, much longer list, and that would be too vague a list. This is a very specific thing that they all mess up.
They mess up.
See, now what's really funny is it can't be anything historical because we're talking Prisoner of Azkaban as well. Infinity War.
And Walking Dead.
And Walking Dead.
So you're right. It isn't history. The first two might have led you down the path of history.
Yeah.
Let us think closer to geography.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So Infinity War, I know there was a goof where a character during the war scene could not have been where they were because of just like a shot earlier, they were shown somewhere else. So is this like translocation of characters happening in real time?
No. That would also again be, I don't know, I imagine a more common error. Perhaps, I don't know. I did create this question specifically for our guest today.
Oh,
that lead you any closer?
Okay, is it got anything to do with birds? Now let me think. But you said it's a goof. It's not just something that's common. It's like a mistake or an error.
Yes.
The only thing about birds and Infinity War, is it the Falcon?
Oh, that's a smart guess, but no. We're not talking about the Falcon here at all.
What was the first?
You're right, it has something to do.
It has something to do with birds.
And I also mentioned geography. So more specifically, location.
Okay, so then I would guess that these movies have some birds, but put them in countries or places where those birds are not actually found. Something like that?
Very, very close, very close. But again, if you are a birder or an ornithologist, as it may be the case, you might know the specific bird and you definitely have heard this sound because it is used. So it is almost like the Wilhelm scream, but for birds, used to create an aura. So in this case, perhaps it might be easier if you knew what the sound was. So I'm telling you very specifically, I'm looking for the name of the bird whose sound is used incorrectly in all these films and multiple other films. If you know the name of the bird, that would be your answer right there. If not, I'll play the sound and then you can tell me. And you definitely have heard this sound in movies.
Are you saying it's the same bird in all the movies?
Exact same bird sound that is used in all these movies in locations where this bird would never be found.
Okay, that's good fun. Okay. Well, we know there's a snowy owl in Harry Potter. So is that the one?
No, the bird is not there in these movies. The sound of the bird.
It's the bird sound. Okay.
Yeah.
Where in Infinity War is there a bird sound?
You won't even believe where.
I'm racking my brain. I don't think there's a single bird. Except for maybe the cabin scene with Tony.
No. There is a bird sound on Thanos' planet.
Oh, God.
You would imagine. Oh. To be fair, Thanos' planet might have this bird. I mean, we don't know.
I do know that a very common bird sound that is used in movies, especially Hollywood movies, to create atmosphere and all, is this bird called the Vipurvil. Is it the same one? Vipurvil.
No. That's a good guess, but no. All right, so you already have gotten pretty close to the answer. And so specifically for the birding enthusiasts in our listeners, and if there aren't any, then hopefully we'll be after this episode. I'm going to play the sound. Hopefully you get it from that. And even if you don't get the name of the bird, you definitely have heard the sound.
Oh, yeah. So this is a loon, right? The loon.
Oh, that is exactly what I was hoping for, actually. I was hoping that you would be able to get it as soon as you heard the sound. So our podcast listeners can hear the sound, but there's a wonderful walks video on YouTube. a pop culture recommendation for every episode from here on out. Go watch Vox Studios. But check out Vox Studios about the call of the loon, the wail of the loon, and how it is misused in all films, most films that it's used in, because it is considered this atmospheric, beautiful, melancholy sound, but it is found in very few locations in the North America. So almost every other place that it is used in is incorrectly used. And yeah, and you probably have heard that sound in a film, even if you didn't know where the sound was of and what animal or bird, but now you do. And that's why we need birders on our show.
Yeah, this would have been a completely useless question with me. Like, you could have gone on giving me clues till Kingdom Come and I still wouldn't have gotten it.
That was good fun. So I hadn't realized that all these kind of things, inconsistencies were there in this film.
So many films. The list is very long. Yeah.
So I just have a query. This is spelled loon as in L-O-O-N?
Yep.
So is it the same loon as in Looney Tunes? So is this a Looney Tune?
This is the original Looney Tune, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't remember the funda exactly, but there is an expression called the crazy loon, which comes from this bird. And so the loon, now I don't know whether loon gets its, I'm not sure about the funda, but then the bird itself gets its name from loony. Because it is supposed to be like, I think, at some time mating season or something, that it makes some weird sounds. I don't know if this was a sound. Which is why in Canada and North, and I guess all of North America, it's called the crazy loon.
Wow,
interesting.
And I have to look that up to see the actual funda, but it's something. There's some funda I know.
No, but again, great question, Aditya. Which again, as I mentioned, I would never have gotten in a million years. So let's go back to Rajiv. Rajiv, hit us again, one more time.
Okay. One more. This one, I think I will do a music question. And I hope that you guys are into music stuff and you can get it. This should be a fairly, a reasonably workable one, I think. So, as you guys know, over the years, many bands and artists have made guest appearances on The Simpsons. You know, Simpsons, they like to get guests of different kinds on the show. So, when it was announced in 2009 that this band, a particular band, was to make an appearance, many websites and newspapers, then they reported that news with a nearly identical and, I think, quite clever headline, Dash to Turn Dash for Simpsons. Now, if the first Dash is the name of the band and the second Dash is the name of the song or a song that the band is very well known for, which is the band and which is the song?
I think I worked it out. I'm not sure. I could be wrong. So then I'm not going to flex or anything. I'm just going to stay very humble and see if Aditya can work this out.
Okay, Aditya, go first.
I'm a bit lost right now. Can you just, remind me, where was this? When was this?
So 2009, it was announced that this band would make an appearance on the show. So, websites and newspapers or whatever, entertainment magazines, announce it saying Dash to Turn Dash for Simpsons. And so they cleverly worked the name of a song by that band into the headline, which is kind of relevant to the whole Simpsons universe.
And loyal listeners of our podcast would know that I've actually loved newspaper headline questions in the past. So right now I'm quite sad that I can't crack this one immediately. No, Vineet, I'd hand it over to you.
Okay. So I think, again, this is just working it out from what Rajiv asked. Again, no flex here. But is this Coldplay Turns Yellow for The Simpsons?
That is right. Well done, Vineet. Yeah, it is Coldplay Turn Yellow because everybody is on The Simpsons is yellow, of course.
Yeah.
And because at that time, the song Yellow. And so they said Coldplay also will turn yellow. I mean, it was a good headline, I think. Well done, really well worked Brilliant. Out. I could see the mental gears turning as the as the question was being read out and then it suddenly clicked in place. Well done, yeah.
That was pretty cool. No, that was a great question and a great answer, Vineet. Yeah, pretty impressive.
Thank you. Okay, my turn. This is a question I came... This is a piece of trivia I came across the other day. And I was like, this is so well-timed. But I also have a feeling that Rajiv may know this. So, I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
A very short question. Practically one of the shortest questions I've asked on the podcast. Bushu Suru. Okay? Bushu Suru is a Japanese word coined to denote a specific faupa. What faupa does it denote? Bushu Suru.
Okay, well, you're wrong in thinking that I might know it because I am the clues. Bushu Suru.
Bushu, Bushu.
Okay.
Bushu Suru.
Does this have anything to do with like eating habit or eating practices like don't dip the sushi in the soy sauce?
No, quite the reverse. Like that? Quite the reverse.
Quite the reverse.
Yeah.
But you said it's a faupa.
It's a faupa. It's a faupa.
But is this a faupa that's kind of limited to Japanese culture, or is it like a general faupa for which the Japanese have come up?
This faupa, this word was specifically coined because that faupa happened at the hands of a non-Japanese person.
Ah, okay.
Is it? Did George Bush do something really stupid?
George
in
Bush did
Japan?
Something in Japan.
Yes, you got that. I'll give you the translation. Let's see if you can get closer to the, you know, more specific answer. Bushu Suru literally means to do the bush thing, or shorter, bushing it.
Okay, now what did he do? I think he went to sleep while there was some sort of a ceremony or some.
That I think,
right?
He does. That he did almost every other day. Yeah, that he did all the time.
Okay.
No, the first question before I let you guys kind of wander down the wrong path is, which bush are we talking about?
Ah, I kind of assumed it was Dabya. It's not Dabya, is it?
It's not Dabya.
Ah,
okay.
So the senior
bush. Senior.
It's a spy, yes. I can't call him a spy. He was a manager of spies.
He was the Judy Dench.
No, he was the director of the CIA, no? Before he became president, he was director of the CIA. During the whole Iran-Contra affair, he was the director of the CIA.
I seem to remember that there was a thing where he collapsed or fainted or something on stage.
Oh, yes. Very, very close. Very, very close. But something happened before he collapsed.
Oh.
You also said it's the opposite of...
eating. Yeah.
Eating. So I always feel bad guessing this, but did he like... did he... I hope it's not soiling. That would have been... I would definitely know if he soiled his pants. So I'm guessing he puked or something?
Yes.
Oh, he puked.
Bushu Suru is the act of vomiting into somebody else's lap.
Oh, God.
Oh, God.
Is that what he did?
Yeah, so this is... And the thing is, no, there's a fascinating kind of side tangent that comes from it. So I'll just give you the history. So while attending a banquet hosted by Japanese Prime Minister Kichi Miyazawa on 8th January 1992, George H.W. Bush fainted after vomiting into Miyazawa's lap.
Oh,
and
God.
Then he basically later attributed the incident to a case of acute gastroenteritis. So he threw up and then he fainted and fell. When his doctor came to him and kind of revived him, he saw what happened and he was like, just leave me under the table and let me know when everybody's left.
Okay.
Now, this is the origin of the term Bushu Suru. What is really fascinating about this is this one incident may have changed the course of scientific history.
What? How?
So, have you heard of the Desertron or the superconducting super collider? Unlikely,
maybe.
Because no. Yeah. So maybe like if you were like very active in the early 90s, you may have heard of it. But the superconducting super collider was a particle accelerator complex which was under construction in Texas. Congress, when it granted the permission to build it, gave it a budget of $4.4 billion. But the budget kept going higher and higher and higher. Right, India at the time. If you're talking late 80s, early 90s, and you know the financial situation of India at the time, India offered to give $50 million. Right.
Wow.
But the budget kept going up higher. Like every year it would go up to 2 billion, another 3 billion. By the time it was scrapped, it had almost gone to around $21 billion. Okay. So this particular project, it was a pet project of a lot of scientists who wanted to do particular accelerator experiments using this Texas supercollider. CERN at the time was only still planning the Large Hadron Collider. Okay, they were only, it was still only in the planning stages. It would come to fruition much later. So this came much before CERN. So when this thing went into such financial crisis, they were looking for partners to bring onto the project. And Japan was on top of the list. Only the Japanese would spend money for all of this. So one of the topics that Bush was going to bring up at that meeting was the partnership for the superconducting supercollider. When he Bushu surued, it kind of ended the night, and Japan was never formally asked to participate. The project was defunded, and CERN went on to prove the Higgs boson with the Large Hadron Collider almost 20 years later.
That's an amazing fund.
One Bushu Suru got a multi-billion dollar science project reduced to a $21 billion hole under Texas.
That's tough, dude.
So, that is Bushu Suru.
Something for George Bush to remember. It's Junior to remember.
Every time somebody criticizes WW, you can just say, but at least I never Bushu Suru. Like, I did read one. I did once read a kindergarten book upside down, but that was...
I think it's something worth remembering that the weapon of mass destruction was inside of you all along. That's what...
Okay, Rajiv, come on, hit us.
Okay, fine. Here's my next question. Okay, since its invention in 1948 by Swiss engineer Georges de Mistral, you know what I'm talking about, Velcro has burgeoned into a multi-billion dollar industry and is used today for thousands of different applications, right? Among the more specific uses for it is in an astronaut's helmet, where typically a small square patch is fixed to the inside of the visor. I can see from Aditya's smile that he probably already knows this, but I'll ask the question, what is the purpose of that small piece of Velcro?
I know this answer, so I'll let Vineet take a guess.
Okay, Vineet, take a guess.
I did know that Velcro was, for one of the first uses for Velcro was in the space program, but I had thought it was mostly for the... They used Velcro on the soles of the boots they were using inside the space shuttle, and also they could move in weightlessness. I did not know about the visor thing. Why would they have Velcro inside the visor?
So I'm sure they used a lot of Velcro in the spacesuit elsewhere for fastening and things like that. But this is a small piece, like a small square piece affixed on the inside of the visor.
On the inside of a visor? I just finished reading Chris Hadfield's The Apollo Murders. You know, astronaut Chris Hadfield, he's written a mystery book, by the way, called The Apollo Murders. There is a sequence in that where one of the astronauts pukes inside his helmet. So that's the only thing that that's coming to mind. But I can't for the life of me think how could that possibly be related to a piece of Velcro.
Sorry, can I just make a small correction? You mean he Bushu Suru'd inside his helmet?
No, he didn't do it in somebody else's lap.
It may have trickled into his own lap eventually, though. But that in fact is kind of a clue, like vomiting. It kind of involves something involuntary.
Sneezing?
No, not quite, but you're getting kind of closer, I suppose.
Probably a lot more common than sneezing.
A lot more common than sneezing?
I think so. I would assume so, yeah.
Breathing? But then what?
No.
That is more common than sneezing.
Velcro is
right?
Not going to help him with breathing.
Okay, what is more common than sneezing? Now, that's that is what I'm going to go by. Blinking. But why would you need Velcro? Okay, no. So I know there are two visors. So the visors of these helmets usually there are two layers. So, right, there's the glass layer, and then there's the reflective layer that they have that they kind of put down when they go for a spacewalk or whenever they're anywhere near exposure to the sun. So is it to keep that in place? But then it wouldn't be on the inside.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be on...
No, I think, like you mentioned, I think it's a bodily function that you're looking at.
But why Velcro?
Something to do with it.
Is it like a spit collection device where it just anything he says spit just gets trapped on the Velcro hooks? No.
No.
Very vehement. No. Nope. I'll need some.
Do you want another clue or should we let Aditya answer it?
Aditya, go ahead.
Yeah, got it.
It is if you're feeling the itch.
Oh!
How would you itch yourself itchy nose. In the space suit? So, when you have an itchy nose, that's what you use the Velcro for.
Yeah, well done, Aditya. So that's true. Simple thing like itching, like scratching your own nose is not possible in a space suit, right? So they put a little bit of Velcro so that the astronaut can actually rub his nose against it in some Velcro, if it itches.
That is a fantastic use of Velcro, I have to admit. That's a very good use of Velcro.
Yeah. Okay. Well done, Aditya.
So now, Aditya, I think you are going to be asking the last question of this episode.
Since I did ask a birding-related question earlier, okay. I'm going to do one more. And
I'm so sorry, Rajiv.
No, I'm fine.
Oh, no. You know, Rajiv proved himself to be a strong birder just by recognizing from the sound what bird it was. So,
props to him for that. I have a feeling that all of us guys were bird watchers at one point.
How?
Oh, especially in college.
Well,
we all have bird watching credentials.
Yeah, but I'm surprised you're saying was, because I think you some habits never go away.
I am married, so the answer is it's definitely gone away. No. That is expired, extinct, gone the way of the dodo.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Only bird you watch is the dodo now. Yeah. Okay. So this question is based in Durban, in South Africa in 2009. And we are talking about the biggest web service provider in the country called Telkom. And they had an ADSL service.
Okay.
This was subpar, to say the least. And people were rather annoyed with it. An employee of an IT company was so annoyed that he decided to challenge the company in a very specific way. And he promised them that he would prove that they are extremely slow. How did he go about doing this?
I have a guess, but I'm going to keep quiet for now.
Oh, an employee, 2009. Seeing as how it is Durban, it's got to be some cricket involved somewhere. Oh no, is that just Durban? No, I don't think I have a clue. Although I feel this is one of those when the answer comes out, that's what happened. Yeah.
This isn't something that would have been historically very significant that all of us would have heard of. It just happens to be a fun little piece of trivia that happened. And I thought we were sharing.
Okay, so the employee of the same company, which is Telkom or something like that, decides to...
No, it's not from the same company. He was an employee of an IT company.
Oh, okay.
But he was annoyed with this service being so slow. And he decided to issue a public challenge to prove how slow this particular service was.
No, I don't think I can figure it out based on what I have. Any other clues?
Okay. So there were a couple of rules involved in this. I'm going to give you the rules and hopefully that will help you. The first one was no cats allowed. And no performance enhancing food item.
Okay. So did he use a pigeon service or something to send a message to somewhere? Okay, is that what he did?
So he challenged them that a pigeon would be able to transfer 4GB faster than the broadband service was able to.
Okay, that's cool.
He took a 4GB thumb drive, tied it to a pigeon and sent it. The distance was 60 miles. 60 miles. The pigeon covered the distance in around 2 hours. And in the same time, the ADSL service had transferred 4% of the data.
So he actually won the challenge.
Won and how, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's cool.
And when I said food item, I meant bird seed, obviously. So bird yeah. seed must not have any performance enhancing seeds within. That was part of the
rule. Okay, that's cool, yeah.
So I think we've reached our quota of questions for this week. But fear not, Rajiv is going to be back next week for one more episode before he decides to say goodbye to us. So let's start the wind-up procedure for this episode. Aditya, what is your question for next week?
Oh, that's very simple. If instead of a pigeon, it was a crow that was used to do the same thing, what would one say at the end of that challenge? And you shall find out in the next episode. I'm so proud of this question because I already know the answer.
Okay. Coming back to the question I asked at the beginning of today's episode. At MIT, you would get a certificate in what if you took archery, pistols, sailing and fencing as your required physical education classes? Rajiv and Aditya, do you have any ideas on what kind of certification would you get if you took physical education classes in archery, pistols, sailing and fencing?
Sounds like some fictional character.
No, it's a certification in something. Like a...
Yeah, it's just like a certification in being Zorro or...
Legolas.
Legolas, yeah. Am I on the right path or no?
No. I mean, like, not... This is not fictional.
Oh, okay. So it's an actual serious certification.
It's not serious. Let's also be clear about that. It's not serious. It's so
serious. Okay.
Not serious, but not fictional. Got it.
My clue to you would be, think historically, what would you be doing if you were expert in fencing, using guns, sailing, and archery?
Well, some sort of a explorer kind of thing?
Close, but think the opposite side of the coin.
Oh.
Scout? Scouting?
No. So explorers are all upright, very... most of them at least, you know, do it for the love of exploring. They're very good and white motives. Think if your motives weren't so white.
So like mercenary or something like that?
Okay. Closer.
Okay, pirate.
Yes. So the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, would give you a certificate in piracy.
Oh, really? That's a good one.
It started in 2011. Students who've completed archery, fencing, pistol, which is air pistol or rifle, and sailing should send an email to Ahoy MITP, which is ahoymitpe@mit.edu, with their name and MIT ID number, and they would get the certificate. And I shit you not, this is an actual disclaimer on the MIT website. The MIT Pirate Certificate is for entertainment purposes only and does not give the recipient license to engage in piracy or any pirate activities.
Okay, then.
That would be a very interesting pirate who refuses to do piracy till they have a certificate saying that they're a pirate.
True that.
So, Aditya, any pop culture recommendations for this week? You've already mentioned Vox videos.
So I'll leave the bulk of the pop culture recommendations to our guest. He's welcome to share all of his favorite movies, books, music.
Rajiv, do you have any pop culture recommendations for our audience this week?
Yes, kind of off the top of my head, all I can think of is something pretty weird. But it is something that... And also, it's a recommendation that will probably classify me as a bit of a weird person. But I highly recommend sheep shearing videos.
I know what you're talking. Very satisfying. So satisfying.
I feel you, Rajiv. They are very oddly satisfying, and sometimes I watch like a few of them in a chunk and it just completely relaxes me. So that and horse hoof, whatever, something, hoof shorting or something it's called.
It is Dr. Hoof. The YouTube channel is called Dr. Hoof.
Yeah.
I have watched it as well.
Correct, yeah.
Oh, it is so satisfying. It is so satisfying. Just the best.
Yeah.
That is a fantastic recommendation. Not yes. weird at all. Because clearly all of us do it.
You have to understand, you're among a community of weirdos. This is normal for us.
This is normal. Well, there's this particular one of this sheep, which just looks like a huge ball of dirt. You know, you can't see any sheeply parts in it. But you know, when she's done with the shearing, this sheep just looks like a newborn baby kind of thing, and it's amazing. You see the transformation. Well, so that's my reco. I don't know how many people are actually going to follow up on that. I suspect there might be quite a few.
Great. Aditya, what's up with you?
I don't even know how to top that anymore. That is such a lovely recommendation. But I have just a single recommendation. And I was going through my list of books recently, and I decided to pick one from years ago that I loved. And I would love for more people to read it, even though a lot of people probably have heard of it. If not the book, the movie, Cloud Atlas. And while the movie is decent, I think the book is pretty great and definitely worth checking out. It's one of those books which has that advantage of when you read it, you're like, oh, this is a lovely use of the format of literature. That the author has used it creatively and in a, well, unusual way, I would say. So check it out. A lovely piece of fiction.
Nice. I'm going to give a recommendation, which is something I would probably not have done a year or 2 years ago because of the fact that it's a very niche industry. So I'm going to be recommending a Malayalam film today. Now that Malayalam films have gone more into the mainstream and they're available with subtitles on various OTT platforms, I feel comfortable recommending this movie. Don't try pronouncing it. I'll just tell you the translation in English so that you can use that name. The name of the movie is Ila Veera Poonjira, which literally translates to The Valley Where Leaves Don't Fall. It is a mystery thriller, very claustrophobic, set at a wireless station on top of a hill in Kerala. There are very few characters, and there is a twist that I never saw coming. The twist is, it is a fantastic twist, and I guarantee you, unless you're superhuman, you'll not see that twist coming at all. And the way they just ratchet up the tension. The movie is a year old, I think a year and a half old. I watched it at that time, but now that a lot more people I know are coming up to me and saying that, oh, I watched that Malayalam film and it was great. And now there are subtitles available. So this is available on Prime Video. Ila Veera Poonjira. I'll put it up on the show notes, or we'll put it up on Instagram so you can find out how to get to that movie. But that's my recommendation for this week.
Perfect.
That's a great recommendation. Yes.
So that's all for this episode. We'll be back with Rajiv for episode number 65. Thank you all for listening in. We hope you enjoyed the show and learned something new. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Take 2 seconds after my spiel to go give us a 5-star rating, hit the subscribe button and the follow button on whichever platform you're listening to us on right now. It helps us reach a wider audience, allows more people to discover and enjoy the show. We'd also love to hear from you. Feedback, suggestions, trivia. If you have a question that you want asked on the show, just send us a mail at ruquizzingme@gmail.com and just mention the name of the quizmaster who you want to ask the question in the subject line. You can also reach us on Instagram at ruquizzingme. We have a subreddit if you want to join our community at r/ruquizzingme. We appreciate your support and look forward to sharing more episodes with you in the future. Rajiv, Aditya and I will be back next week for another round of quizzing. Thank you again for tuning in. Have a great day.
See you guys next week.
And thank you so much for having me. Looking forward to next week's episode.
Bye.